Our Creator, I pray that Thou make me an instrument of Your mercy and Your peace and help someone in this room today, even if it's only me. I know that the speech is going to go well today because God's favorite word is impossible. So there's probably everyone here is either an addict or an alcoholic, codependent, but I'm still going to define some terms from my own perspective. What is an alcoholic? An alcoholic is someone who drives their car into a tree and afterwards get out of the car and says, I got to quit driving. And the addict drives their car into the same tree, gets out of the car and laughs and says, wasn't my car. And a codependent will crash their car into that tree, and you're wondering, how could this possibly come out? They'll crash their car into the tree, do all the responsible, correct things, call the police, make sure that they get the emergency rescue people there. Everything, cross your T's, dot your I's, it's all done. And the next day, though, they're out there with a chainsaw cutting that tree down. It's your fault! Sorry, guys. I'm all three, so I get it. My old sponsor said that an alcoholic is someone that can be characterized by three words: loss of control. I'm an alcoholic. I lost my control for many, many years. I only got drunk once for 19 years. And so I was confused about whether I was an alcoholic or not until I hit the powerless point. But you have to be conscious that it's a powerless point. I was powerless all along. But I didn't have my wake-up call. Even driving under the influence of alcohol and killing this child did not wake me up to the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict as well. I haven't suffered from using in a very long time. I quit using before I quit drinking just because I wasn't really interested in it. And really, I didn't keep using after I quit drinking because I had a lot of respect, like for marijuana. You know, I thought it'll lead me back to the bottle. I didn't want to risk my recovery by having a joint, you know. And but when I first used speed, for example, I found out I was an addict within a couple of weeks, because within two weeks, I was doing burglaries to support my habit. One fine day, I'm walking down LaSalle Avenue, and you won't be able to prove any of this. So, and I had a pistol from a robbery, and I stuck it in a guy's face. I followed him across the street. He saw me following him, and he tried to run, kind of get away from me. And when I walked up behind him, he turned around and gave me a stern look, like, "What are you?" And then I pulled up the pistol and I stuck it in his face, and I said, "Give me your money." And he stepped back and fear, and he said, "You're kidding, right?" And I pulled back that hammer and I stuck it right between his eyes and I said, "Give me your money." And he reached into his pocket and he pulled out his wallet and he shoved it at me. He says, "Here, take it, take it, take it." But while I was holding that pistol between his eyes, I was asking myself, I was going, "Oh my God, what have I become that I'm sticking a pistol in somebody's face?" So I decided to stop using that day, and I never used speed again for the rest of my life. So somehow I was able to quit drugs, but I couldn't do the same thing with alcohol. It was very difficult for me because I didn't recognize a powerlessness. With the codependency, being in Al-Anon, I had a loved one who drank herself to death on December 8th of 2010, is when she passed. I was out of the relationship for quite some time before that, but, you know, we saw the writing on the wall. Her daughter found her dead in bed on a Friday night, and, you know, and that was a tough one. She was an accomplished woman. She was a really good artist. She went to William and Henry on the East Coast for art, and she had a lot of potential, but she was buried in a bottle, and it finally killed her. So alcoholism kills people. And I know for me, when I drink, I kill people. Now, if you look at this picture of this little boy and ask yourself, if it would have been you who drove under the influence and hit little Timmy, that was his name, it's Timothy Wilburn, do you think you'd be able to live with that knowledge? Or do you think you might have to consider suicide because you couldn't live with that knowledge? Anybody raise your hand? You think it might be a little tough? Yeah. It would at least cross your mind. Maybe you wouldn't do it, you know. It certainly crossed my mind, but not until I sobered up. But conversely, if someone would have hit your loved one, if this was your child, would you consider homicide? Would it cross your mind? Oh, yeah. Usually it's the same hands that go up when I ask that question. So we're talking about life and death. Alcoholism, for us, is life and death. And for me, when I drink, I will not hesitate, at least historically, to get behind the wheel of a car and drive that vehicle under the influence of alcohol, thus endangering the life of others and myself. So it's both suicidal and homicidal at the same time. I mean, you just never know which one's going to die. But when I came to terms with the fact that I was powerless over alcohol, I was just released from Stillwater Penitentiary. I got out on a Friday, which now is illegal. They don't let people out on Friday, and it wasn't all because of me, but, you know, they let me out on a Friday. And I got unpacked. Saturday, I went to Carboni's to have a piece of pizza and a 3-2 beer, because it's not real beer. And I wanted to prove to those AAs that I'm not an alcoholic, because I had attended AA in prison for the coffee, basically, you know. But I had heard some things, and they said, if you're not an alcoholic, then you can drink and stop anytime you want. Well, I've been trying to do that for years, but it hadn't occurred to me that when you have the knowledge of what you read in the big book and you apply it to the problem, the solution to the problem, it manifests differently. So I'm trying to prove that I'm not an alcoholic, and I was going to have one or two beers, but that first beer, I tell you what, it really tasted good, and it is beer. And it went straight into my system. I started to relax. I started to feel high. I felt the beer go down my throat, and it just blossomed in my stomach, and I just felt this wave of love and relaxation go into my system. And I thought, oh yeah, I guess another's not going to hurt anything. So I got a second little glass, and then I ordered a pitcher. And then I looked at the clock, and I saw what time they quit letting people order beer, which was earlier than what I approved of. And so I ordered a second pitcher before I had drank the first one. And I thought, oh, why not? And then I ordered a third one before I was halfway done with the first pitcher. So I'm sitting there at a small table with three pitchers of beer in front of me. And there's this little voice going on saying there's something wrong with what's happening here. But I'm already feeling my exuberance starting to come out. And I lost all rhyme and reason at that point, and I decided to hit every bar in Stillwater. And I behaved in a way that violated a number of laws. I was threatening people. And I did what I always did when I was drinking. I lost my power. I gave my power away. I gave it to alcohol. And the day before I got out of prison, I was standing there looking at these guys, thinking, I hate these people. I hate being locked up. And if I have to come back again to do time, I'm going to plant a piece of steel in somebody's chest, or I'm going to force somebody to murder me, but somebody's dying. That's how spiritually bankrupt I was. I did not want to do any more time, and they told me. They made me sign a document saying that I can't drink. I might not know I'm an alcoholic, but they know I've got this history, and they don't want me drinking out there. So, and I signed the document to get out of prison, otherwise you stay in. A couple of days later, I'm behaving in a way that is completely inimical to my interest, completely inimical to my will to not drink and get in trouble. I was hitting on men's wives and girlfriends. I was threatening guys, saying, if you don't like the way I'm talking right now, let's step out to the alley and solve this little problem. And, you know, realistically, I'm drunk. You know how easy it is to beat up a drunk guy, you know? It would have been a simple measure. They were just looking at me like I was the biggest idiot that they had seen in quite a while. And they would just shake their head and walk away. Nobody took me to task. I wasn't thrown out by the bouncers. The police weren't called. I wasn't beat up. All these things happened before. And no matter how I behaved, it seemed like there was something happening where I was being protected from the bust. It was like walking through a minefield of danger and not stepping on any of the mines, even though you can't see them. And a lot of us in recovery, we complain about the condition of our lives, but we don't know that we've been walking on water for so long and that we're alive despite incredible odds, that we don't see the water for what it really is. We're not supposed to still be here. Many of us should have died over and over and over again. Thank God life ain't fair. If life was fair, I'd be in prison right now, because I've done a lot more than what I've got caught for. So when I hear someone say, well, life ain't fair, yeah, you're right. Well, thank God it ain't fair. I'd still be paying my dues, man, you know. But fortunately for me, I came into this program on August 19th of 90 after laying in bed, puking uncontrollably, which is what told me I was powerless, and it was loud. I figured people could hear it, and they would call somebody to save my life. And I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And I remember looking at the clock on the wall that read 3:30. I knew I was an alcoholic. And I knew I was powerless over alcohol. And I had decided that my life could be restored to sanity through my higher power, God. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of God at that moment. And I came to AA in Stillwater the very next day. And even though I knew I was an alcoholic, when I stood at the bottom of the stairs, I was scared to go in. And I heard this loud, uproarious laughter just come floating out of the house. And I thought, oh, I know that sound. That's what we do in prison to survive. And it was like a sign to me. I thought, oh, maybe I do belong here. And I walked up with, you know, facing my fears, and I went in and met a few people, sat down, and I knew I was an alcoholic, but when the meeting started and they started going around the room saying, I'm so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic, I thought, oh no, I got to say it. And it got closer and closer to me, and my pride was so big, I didn't want to say I was an alcoholic, even though my ego was still like locked in, as if being an alcoholic is something ugly and bad. In reality, it's the most beautiful thing, one of the most beautiful things that has transpired in my life. When it came to me and I said, I'm Timothy and I'm a and I coughed out the word alcoholic, and my head didn't blow up like a Scanners movie or anything, and I felt really more clean because I stated the truth out loud, you know, and I was in a room of equals. We have a fellowship of equals in the program, whether it's AA or Al-Anon. In Al-Anon, they even read that we are a fellowship of equals. And I like that so much. I can be a man in a meeting that is majority of women and not be judged for being a male. I'm just a member. And that is so life-changing, to be treated as a human rather than as a man. And it doesn't happen everywhere at all times. We're human, yeah. Humans do things. We separate by gender sometimes, and if that's what works for you, you need to do that. That's a healthy thing for some people. For other people, it's not healthy. Figure it out. Your higher power will help you with that, and your sponsor will help you with it. But for me, it's not a requirement for my recovery to go to a men's group, although I've done it. I'm not judging, I'm just saying. Is that it's a we program, and it doesn't say that we split up by race, gender, class. And I know we tend to do that. We got lawyers, AA, and doctors, AA, and people that think they're special, and they're doing the I thing, and they're compartmentalizing. And maybe they are special, I don't know. But there's something about leveling that is so extremely important. It's like people go to Hazelden and they say, oh, this is like one of the best treatment centers in the country, and their pride might get attached to that. Well, you know what? With Hazelden, like any treatment center in the country, it is protected from itself by a higher power that they allow. When I drive in here, I feel like this place is protected by an umbrella of peace. That's real. That's not imagined. I literally feel that. It's a spiritual feeling. And it's not like when you go into prison. You don't get that feeling in prison. You know? I know the difference. So this is a place of freedom. It's a place of peace. So I'm not putting down the treatment idea, but here's the deal. All right? Treatment is where you pay $20,000 or $30,000 to find out that AA is free. There's some truth in that. But, you know, we show up at AA for one reason, and then we stay for another. It's like I showed up to get sober, but I stay sober now to go to AA because I enjoy it. I'm not worried about falling down and getting drunk and going to jail. I have great respect for alcohol, don't get me wrong. I know the enemy. I have met the enemy, and it is me. They say that drinking was just a symptom. Drinking was not our problem. We had a thinking problem. Well, what led up to that? What was I like? What led up to me to be an alcoholic and take somebody's life? You think I woke up one morning and said, guess I'll go drive under the influence in a stolen car and run from the police and kill somebody? No, that was not my intention to go that way. I was born into a family where both my mom and dad were alcoholics. They were divorced at an early age. My mom was a very troubled individual. She couldn't take care of our kids. We were taken away by the state of Minnesota. And they cited our case as the worst case of abuse that they'd seen in the state. She used to tie me in a crib with strips from the sheets and leave me there for 2 or 3 days. And because I could get out on my own, my little brother, he couldn't, so he wasn't tied in. You know, it's a good thing they took us away. You know, we were out, when they finally came and took us, we were outside naked eating mud pies. We would make mud pies and literally eat them from where the cars would park in the gutters. That's where the sand and mud was. And we'd eat them. And when we got to the hospital, our stomachs had been protruding from all the dirt that we had been eating for some period of time. And when they took me away in the squad, I was banging on the back window, screaming for my mom because I saw her on the street corner, holding down one street corner while a friend of hers, female friend of hers, was holding down another part of the street corner. And that's where they were, and that's what they did. And, you know, people do what they got to do to survive. And she is an addict. She's an alcoholic. We do things. You know, I say we do things. I'm not judging her. You know, she did the best she could with what she had, period. She deserves no condemnation for that. So they moved us to a foster home where I was sexually abused for the next 7 years. It was not a fun place to be. I didn't understand all of what was going on because I was so young, but I did know that my freedom was being removed from me, and I didn't like that. And I was diagnosed while I was there as autistic. I would sit in a chair and rock for hours, and if somebody touched me gently like the offender would, I would scream like you were touching me with a hot poker or something. And I'd run my head into walls, break holes in the walls, and then spread feces on the walls. And they said, well, he's autistic, he's got some serious behavioral issues. Well, what they didn't know is that I was being abused and that the only place I was breaking the windows and wiping the feces was above the bed where I was being abused. I wasn't telling on him because he made me keep it a secret, you know. And if you tell, you're not being loyal, you're being a bad kid. And, you know, kids can't process that stuff, you know. And obviously it happens to little boys too. Happens to girls more than it happens to boys, but it happens to us all. But one day my foster mother just threw her hands up. I can't deal with this kid anymore. She said she hated me and she wanted me out of the house, and I concurred. I didn't want to be in a house where somebody hated me. And they sent me to an orphanage in Duluth. Best 2 years of my life. I got treated like a kid for the first time. And I work at a place called 180 Degrees now, and one of the facilities that we operate is Brittany's Place that houses young females, 9 to 15 or so, who have been sexually trafficked. They go there for treatment, but they go there to be girls again. They get to be little girls again. And that's all I ever wanted, is just be me. You know, and I wish I would have had that opportunity extended for before and after, but that wasn't my life. The orphanage was sold to the state of Minnesota. They turned it into a quasi-functional correctional facility for troubled youth. Asked me if I wanted to stay, and I said, well, of course, it's the only happy place I'd ever been. And I spent the next 6 months in a lot of trouble. I became an alcoholic. I went down to the sand pits behind the orphanage. I'm going to call it an orphanage. It was now a residential place called Woodland Hills. Down to the sand pits for a party and got drunk. Everyone else went home, and I'm still thirsty. And I'm 14 years old. So I went down to commit my first felony at 14, and I broke into a store. What kind of a store do you think it was? It was a liquor store. Yeah. And I took a rock and I broke in the window and I grabbed the two biggest bottles of juice that I could find, two big yellow half gallons of something, I don't know what it was. And I ran back to the sand pits and I woke up with one of them. I don't know where the other one disappeared to. And it was partially consumed, maybe a third. I drank maybe a third of it. I thought, oh my gosh, I got to get back, you know. So I sneaked back into the place, and the next day they said, you smell kind of weird. You doing something? And they got a report of the break-in, and they figured out maybe it was me, but they couldn't prove anything. So, but anyway, they kicked me out for being incorrigible. Sent me to three group homes where everyone was either an alcoholic or a drug addict, and were physically abusive. The last group home I went to, Freeport West, we had a group mother, a group father, and a counselor to have lots of extra hands on board to help us kids. And, well, when the group father was away going to a store or Ace Hardware or Cub or something, the counselor was hammering the group mother, and we could hear the noises coming from the bedroom. And so I'm just giving you this message that I grew up without any good role models, none. I didn't see good role models. We would sit and smoke dope and drink and use drugs with the group parent. And they said, well, if you don't do it with us, you might go out there and buy some weed that's laced with something and it'll kill you. At least here you're getting the weed from us. And it's all good, you know. I thought, oh, perfect sense. But then when I started drinking alcoholically, I've never stayed free longer than 90 days from the time I take the first drink, so I started committing crimes. I would steal cars. I got arrested, went to Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility, was there about 18 months, turned adult, and they said, you know, Timothy, you haven't learned anything while you were here. We're going to put you out as an adult. Now you're going to suffer adult consequences. And I said, no, I'll be fine because I hate you people. I won't get in trouble again because of my hatred for you. And they said, we don't believe that. Well, within 2 weeks of my release, I was in trouble again for the exact same thing. Hennepin County Jail, driving a vehicle under the influence of alcohol, stolen. They gave me a year in the workhouse. I flattened a year out. The guard that was processing me out on my 365th day, he said, you've learned nothing. You'll be back. And I just heard that a year earlier, but I didn't put that together. I just got mad at this guy. And I just thought, hey, he can't do anything to me. What's he going to do, lock me up? This is my last day. So I started talking about his mama and some other stuff. And, you know, and that what you just did is laugh. That's what he did, too. He laughed, and he threw me a pair of 44 pants. Said, here you go. There's your dress out, you know. Threw me a shoelace. There's your belt. So I took my shoelace and I strung it through there and I, it's fine, I don't care. Give me something, I'm out of here, you know. But within a couple of weeks of getting out again, I got in trouble again. And this time they said, you can either go to St. Cloud Prison or you can go to treatment. Which do you want? I'm crying up a storm. I said, I'm tired of being locked up. Normal people, this doesn't happen to. Why is this happening to me? But the tears weren't all real, because I really wasn't ready to change. I just didn't want to go to prison. So I was letting the tears just pour out. But there was a part of me that was being honest. I didn't want to be doing what I was doing. I didn't want to be in jail. I did want to be like normal people who don't do the stuff I was doing. But my thinking was pretty damaged. You know, my belief systems were pretty damaged, and I was still pretty young. And I was not being treated for my issues. So I went to treatment for a short period of time. I believed that they were insane and I was okay. So I jumped out of the window at 3:30 in the morning. True story, 3:30, sobered up at 3:30, jumped out of a window at 3:30, years apart. And I ran away from the treatment center, violating my probation. I went down to Texas and worked in a carnival and hid out. And within a month, I had relapsed and I was stealing cars again. Got pulled over by a cop. He came up to my car, and I rolled down the window, and I had only had a few beers, and I gave him a huge smile. I said, how you doing, officer? You know, when a cop pulls you over, you got to be nice, right? You know. And I said, oh, I'm doing pretty good. It's a nice night. And we were chit-chatting. He says, you know, you seem like a really nice kid. Why don't you just go home and sleep it off? He could tell I'd been drinking. Well, I've been drinking every day, you know, so he probably had a good eye for that. But back then, this is 77, May of 77, they weren't doing what they do today. Now they know how important it is to get someone off of the street, you know, so they don't kill themselves with somebody else. He followed me for a little ways, didn't even ask me for my ID. That still floors me, you know. He trusted the way I looked. That's all he needed to see. He tried to size me up, and he tried to do me a solid. The cop does you good, you know, you appreciate it. Normal people do. I just thought, old boy's a sucker, man. You know, I got over again. I'm smarter than him. He went one direction, I went another, and the next week, I'm driving down the same stretch of road, but this time I'm drunk and I'm weaving all over the road. People are hitting their horns, flashing their lights when I cross the center line, and then I'd go into the shoulder and I'd hear the gravel and I'd come back out, and then I'd try to keep going in a straight line and I couldn't do it. Lights came on behind me and a little siren came on. I thought, oh no. And I pulled over. Cop was walking to my car, and I tried to reconstruct the little Broadway act I did the week prior. And the cop comes in my car, and I put on a big smile, and I rolled down the window. Yeah, they had roll downs, you know, rolled down the window. And I looked up at him and decided to say nothing. Why? It's the same cop. And I just thought, yeah, you know, some guys just have some bad luck. Couldn't have anything to do with my behavior, right? And he was kind of upset when he recognized me, put me in cuffs, you know, patted me down for weapons, put me in the back of the car, and we're going to the jail. And he says, you're the same snot-nosed little punk I pulled over last week, huh? And I decided to say nothing. I didn't want to get beat up or something, and I didn't get smart with him. But I gave him a false name in jail, and they let me go on probation. They never found out who I was. I had been chewing my fingerprints to obliterate him, and I kept chewing on them every day for 90 days. And just before I got out, one night I had a dreadful dream where I was peering into this white mist, and a conduit formed through the white mist, and at the very end of the conduit was a naked infant, white child, dangling motionless with a noose around his neck, dead. And then that disappeared, and then I was peering into the mist again. A conduit again formed, and then there was a steeple with a clock in it that read a 10:45. And I woke up from that dream questioning my sanity. I thought I had absolutely flipped my wig. I was having some kind of a psychotic break. And I had had psychotic breaks before. When I was 16 in Lionel Lakes, I had one where I was ready to kill myself because of all the psychotic breaks. I prayed about it, and I said, if there's really a God, please save me from this because I'm ready to check out. And I heard a voice say, rest, my child. And all the psychosis went away instantly, and I went to sleep for the first time in a long time, peacefully, and I woke up without anything wrong the next morning. It was gone. So I had this dream, and I didn't know what it meant, and I didn't know why I had it, and I just thought I was nuts. I didn't tell anyone about it. And about 3 days later, I could function well enough to where it wasn't totally freaking me out. And I just dismissed it as a really bad nightmare. But 3 months later, I'm driving through the state of Missouri en route to Florida to work in Disney World. That was my intention. I went back up to Minnesota, stole another car because I'm a genius, and thought that's how I'm going to get to Florida. So as I'm going through the state of Missouri, I picked up a hitchhiker. We shared a six-pack. I dropped him off in a small town called Marshall. And then I was trying to get my way out of town is where I hit Timmy in a baby stroller and his mom, who was pushing the baby stroller across the street. I made an alcohol-impaired decision. Had I been sober, that would not have happened. The car was hot. The police were looking for me because I'd ran into a sign and had knocked over the sheriff's, who's running for re-election. It said, sheriff running for re-election. The sign fell down in front of the car, you know. And I backed up, and it fell to the gravel. So I'm trying to get my way out of town, and they're looking for me. And I hit her. And when I ran over that stroller, I heard this low, gravelly crunching sound beneath the vehicle, which I just assumed was a muffler. Because when I saw her crossing the street, she was walking with another woman, her sister, which is Susan, holding little Timmy there. The baby's name was Timmy. That's all I saw was the women. And I tried to avoid hitting them, made an alcohol-impaired decision, turned the wheel suddenly to the left, and I was already making a left-hand turn. And the car spun out of control. The back end of the car went up into a yard, left some tracks there, and I slid down. Then I went to the center of the street, sliding sideways, and I knew I was going to hit them both unless I could do something to maybe at least straighten the car out where I'm not taking the whole street. And I don't know how I did it, but I got the car straightened out, and I'm just going straight toward these women, and I just said a little prayer. I said, God, please don't let me hit them. One woman ran to safety, and then it's like everything went into slow motion. What took maybe a second seemed to take an eternity. I got closer and closer and closer to the woman, and then she stopped in front of the vehicle, turned, and looked me in the eyes. And then it sped back up, and I collided with her hip, which jettisoned her up into the air, and she came down in front of the car, and I ran over her legs. I didn't know that at the time. She's told me this. And then I heard that low gravelly crunching sound beneath the vehicle. And, you know, when you see a cop show and they're chasing the crook and they have the obligatory scene of the chassis dragging the dragging the asphalt or something and the sparks flying and the sounds, and you just hear that noise. It's exciting. It's just part of the movie. But when I hear it, it brings me instantly back to that time and place because I remember it. It doesn't damage me the way it used to now, but that's what it would do. It would remind me of it. And then I'd see a woman pushing a stroller across the street with a child in it. After I sobered up, I was beside myself. But you see, the reason you don't know what that's like is because you still have your innocence. You know, you have the same, if you're an alcoholic, you have the same disease that I have. And chances are there's people who aren't alcoholic who have driven under the influence. You don't have to be an alcoholic for this to happen. You don't have to have a disease for this to happen. Problem drinker, possibly. Who gets behind the wheel and drives a car under the influence? That, to me, is a problem drinker. You can call it anything you want. Drinking distorts our perception. If it didn't do it, we wouldn't drink. That's why we drink, is so it distorts our perception. We feel relaxed artificially. Rather than getting it from the inside, we try and get it from the outside and find God in the bottom of a bottle or something, I don't know. And it doesn't work, at least not for me. So I went to jail after hitting little Timmy and being told by the cop that I had run over a baby. I didn't know that I had done that. Hearing those words was, I just said, what? And he says, you know, you just ran over a little baby. They got me to the jail. They took all my clothes off, put me into a rubber room, which is polyurethane floor, 16-foot-high ceiling, padded walls, so you can't harm yourself, hang yourself. And I just waited in there for about an hour and a half. They had turned the lights off and they turned the AC down, I'm pretty sure, on purpose. I was really freezing in that room. About an hour and a half later, a cop comes to my cell, and I hear a key go in the door. The light gets flipped on. It's got a little chuck hole in the bottom of the door that they put your food through. And he stares at me for about 10 minutes while I'm standing in the corner like this with my hands in front of myself. And after he's there a few seconds, I saw he's not going anywhere. I wondered what his trip was. And, you know, but for 10 minutes he stared at me, and then he just made a noise like of utter disgust with me. And he went to the next cell, and I heard him tell the guy in the next cell, he said, "I want you to know something. The guy locked up in that cell, he's a baby killer." And that's when I found out that little Timmy had died. And then he went to the next cell and said, "The guy locked up's a baby killer. I want you to know that. He's a baby killer." Told the guys in the next cell, crossed over the little block and told everybody. Then he came back and stared at me for another few minutes and then left. Slammed the door behind him from the little cell block area. And I thought, as soon as I heard that, I thought, oh my God. It was like a million needles went up and down my body. And there's no way to describe the pain that I was feeling at that point. And I was scared for my life. Because if you get locked up and somebody labels you a baby killer, there's only a few things that could possibly happen to you. One, you're going to fight for the rest of your sentence. Two, you're going to get killed. Or three, you're going to get raped. Something bad is going to come out of that. And they don't do interviews to find out how the baby died. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to be fighting for my life for the rest of my sentence. And that cop just gave me a death sentence, possibly. I was concerned that all the guys were going to go off on me, and one guy did start screaming the words baby killer over and over. And just when I thought he wasn't going to have everyone else join with him, they all did, as if in unison. And they all were shaking their cell bar screaming, "Baby killer, baby killer, baby killer." And I felt like I was about this tall. I just felt like I was compressed into just a little black speck in the bottom of that cell. And the chest, my chest felt like it was going to explode every time they yelled baby killer. And when they didn't yell it, it would retract a bit, and then it would expand more when they'd yell it. And then out of nowhere, out of this deep spiritual pain, I just yelled out the words, no logic at all. I just yelled out, "Who do you think you are calling me a baby killer when you guys are so drunk you can barely pronounce the words baby killer?" And really, the only difference between them and me is that they didn't have someone crossing the street in front of their vehicle while they're driving impaired. Maybe they weren't all there for driving impaired. I don't know. But when I speak at MAD panels, that's something I try and point out. And it may be the obvious for you, too. It's not what we do, what we have our convictions for, and the damage we've done necessarily. It's what's underlying it. What was my drinking problem? What was it really? It was my thinking problem. Where did I come from in my life that got me to a point to where I'm in a place now where I'm suicidal and homicidal? And the thing about this 12-step program is it's all about love. It draws you out of the self-hatred and the judgment of others for what they've done, who they are, what they're doing. And the objective of the program and the objective of my speech is to bring people into a more loving place. If you love someone, you won't hurt them. If you love yourself, you won't hurt yourself. That hurt me too. I have to live with that for the rest of my life, and so does Sherry. Sherry is Timmy's mom. But she and I are now friends, and she's forgiven me for her own reasons. But I would have never gotten involved with MAD unless I met a woman in MAD who was also in recovery named Mary Jo Robinson. I was sober for 90 days. She was our speaker at the AA club. And when I'm talking about this at MAD, I can't say AA and all that stuff so easily, so it's kind of cool I can say that here. But I thought, you know, why are they going to have a MAD speaker coming in to talk to us, man? We're just going to have someone tell this god-awful story, and they're going to guilt us and, you know, turn on the blame thrower and just let us have it, you know? I didn't want any part of it, and I was experiencing a thing that we've heard in the Big Book called contempt prior to investigation, otherwise known as prejudice. I hadn't heard her speak a single word, but I already knew everything she was going to say, right? You know, So she stands up and she says, "Hi, I'm Mary Jo R., and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, sober by the grace of God, 21 or 22 years at that time." I thought, oh, geez, I saw the folly of my belief system instantly. She's one of us. Of course, that's why she's here. And she talked about forgiveness in a way I'd never heard before. Her son was killed by a drunk driver, Mark. He was in sobriety for 10 years when he was killed. When she lost him, her heart was just crushed. She loved him dearly. And when she went into the courtroom to give her victim impact statement, what she did was probably different than what many of us could possibly do. She decided to forgive this guy. She said, "One, I'm a Christian. Two, I'm in AA. Both teach forgiveness. And now that I'm here in a difficult place, was I just talking the talk, or am I going to walk the walk? I lost one of the most precious people that I've ever had in my life. And the guy who did it, he's standing over there waiting to get sentenced on the other side of the courtroom." She was going to give her victim impact statement. She looked over at him and said, "Son, would you please look at me when I give you my statement?" And he didn't want to look at her. I mean, I wouldn't want to if it was me. I pled guilty to my crime when I saw the photographs of the stroller with blood on it. It's a god-awful sight, and I just knew there's no way I could drag this mom to a trial to re-experience losing her son again. Couldn't do it. I pled guilty, and they sentenced me to 10 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary for Men at Jeff City. They called it the bloodiest 47 acres in America. It was not something I was looking forward to. I was 20 years old. I was the youngest person there when I got there. I was terrified. But Mary Jo asked him to look at her. And he wouldn't. She asked one more time. He still stared at the ground, not because of obstinance or something. And she broke a rule. She started to cross the courtroom. And she wanted to connect with him. And as she walked across, the bailiffs didn't prevent her for some reason. Usually they would. She approached him and said, "Son, would you please look at me when I give you my statement?" And he still looked at the ground. And Mary Jo said when she made eye contact with his mom, who was sitting near him, she was shooting daggers out of her eyes at Mary Jo with the look, "Don't you hurt my son. He knows what he's done. He already hurts enough. He doesn't need more from you." She didn't know what Mary Jo was en route to do. And she gently reached her hand out and placed it underneath his chin and asked his permission to look him in the eyes again. And she raised up his face and their eyes met. And she said, "I want you to know something. I want you to know that I love you and I forgive you for killing my son." And what do you think his reaction was at that time? He cried. He broke down sobbing. It got down to his soul. And she wanted him to see her eyes because the eyes are the windows to the soul. And if he saw her as just a voice and didn't connect as a human being, then he might have missed a lifetime healing situation. He might not have believed it. If Sherry, the mother, told me that she forgave me when I was in early recovery, I wouldn't have believed it. I believe it now. Because I believe people now, when they say they forgive someone. But I didn't think it was possible to be forgiven for what I did. But this guy's life was changed forever, and that story touched my heart, and I told her what I had done. And she said, "You need to come down and speak for MAD." And I says, "I can't do that. I'm not a speaker." And she says, "Well, that's too bad, because in this program, when we get asked to do service, you're just kind of out of luck. You know, you don't get to say no." And she said, "Plus, what if there's somebody in that audience who happens to be an alcoholic? And we dedicate ourselves to doing 12-step work. You might save somebody's life." She said, "Timothy, this isn't all about you." I went, "Oh, geez. All right," kind of had me there. And I just told her, "I don't know if I can do it." And she said, "Come down and check it out. Check out a panel." I went to a panel. It was great. It was higher coincidences all over, synchronicities galore. I knew I was supposed to be there. I knew I was going to continue with MAD. And so I did. And now it's been 25 years this month that I've been speaking with MAD. They helped change my life. And I've learned a lot about forgiveness in MAD. There's a woman whose daughter was killed, or was injured, I'm sorry. When she saw her in the hospital, she said she didn't recognize her own daughter. And had she had a double-gauge shotgun, she said, in her hands at the time, and had the guy who hit Chris, her daughter, been there, she'd have pulled both triggers without hesitation, without hesitation. So she would have went and did time. Talk about what I asked you in the opening. What would you do if it was your kid? You know, that's what she would have done. But after I was in MAD for a few years, we were speaking on a panel together, and I was sitting down waiting for my turn while she was speaking, and she said, I used to want to kill the guy that hit my daughter. And I used to have so much anger and hatred toward him, but I no longer feel that way because of him, and pointed at him. And I went, oh. And she said, when he first came to MAD and asked to volunteer, I'm going to just tell you what she said. I gave him every shit job I could find because I didn't believe him. And after a year of working with her, she realized I was serious. But when she said that, I thought, really? I didn't know you gave me any nasty jobs. I mean, you know. Because, you know, in the program, when you're doing service work, you don't think about that stuff. You're just there to serve. You know, if you love someone, you won't hurt them. If you love them, you'll serve them too, right? And you don't even notice the things. That's why in our relationships, if we can just love the person we're with rather than judge them and get mad, because we all do it, we're human, it's going to happen, you know. But unconditional and love, that's just redundant, you know. Love is unconditional. If you love someone, you won't hurt them. Not on purpose, at least, right? So this woman's life was changed because Mary Jo said do some service work. And other victims have found some peace in their heart because an offender came forward and said they were sorry for what they did. And they found some healing because their offenders had never stepped up and did anything. And it never occurred to me that I'd be helping the victims in this way. They said that, not me. And Sherry, she is really proud of the fact that I'm remembering little Timmy's name, not just letting his name disappear off the face of the earth. I'm honoring his name. And Timothy means honor God in Greek, and he has the same name that I have. So I hope he's looking down from heaven and he approves of what I'm doing too, and that I'll meet him someday and he'll give me a hug like Mary Jo gave the guy who killed her son a hug. When I was in prison, I want to give you a little background on a poem I found and share the poem. Have you seen your packet? You saw some poetry in there maybe? You know? There's a couple poems I wrote, and then a poem that changed my life written by W.H. Auden, titled The More Loving One. When I was in the prison library at Oak Park Heights, we had not a lot of books, but I was looking at some love poetry. And I didn't want any of the guys knowing I was looking at love poetry, but I saw this one poem that said looking up at the stars, because there was only two things about doing time that disturbed me. One was not being able to stand in a field at night and look up at the stars. It's the most beautiful thing. And the second was no contact with females. You know, it was the only two things that bothered me about doing time. But I saw this poem, and I took three books of poetry, and I put like a book on architecture on the bottom and some book of math on the top, you know, or something. I don't know. But I took some books that looked dry and masculine. Masculine, because, you know, men don't read poetry except for I do. You know? But I didn't want the guys to see me being weak, right? So I take these love poems back to my cell, and I read that poem by W.H. Auden. And at the time I read it, I thought it was talking about man's inhumanity to man and the indifference that we sometimes show to each other. But when I sobered up, it meant something totally different. He wrote, "Looking up at the stars, I know quite well that for all they care, I can go to hell. But on earth, indifference is the least we have to dread from man or beast. How should we like it were stars to burn with a passion for us? We couldn't return. Helena, if equal affection cannot be, let the more loving one be me. Admirer as I think I am, of stars that do not give a damn, I cannot, now I see them say, I missed one terribly all day. And were all the stars to disappear or die, I should learn to look at an empty sky and feel its total dark sublime, though this might take me a little time. Anyone here ever done a darkness retreat? You can't see anything. You're in darkness. And to see the light when you're in darkness, it takes a certain kind of a spiritual awareness. It's there. There's a light shining in darkness. The darkness doesn't know about it. That's okay. When someone's in their disease, they may not know what they're doing. They are in darkness. Don't judge them. They have a disease. This is what they mean by someone having a disease. If a person was eating too many hamburgers and he became obese, had a heart attack while he was driving, and he ran into this kid and killed him, would he be put in prison? No. But the disease of alcoholism got me in prison. So what are they doing with the disease of alcoholism but shaming it and saying, don't be an alcoholic, you know? But they're starting to change it slowly but surely. Lawmakers are getting to the point where they're saying, maybe we need to step it up here and get some people in some treatment. You know, we got red flags and we got warnings going on in these guys' lives. Instead of just incarcerating them, how about if we actually address the issue? You know, don't just address the drinking and do a consequence and nothing else directly like associated as happened to me. But if I had went to treatment while I was in prison at least, then maybe I could have changed. I didn't go to treatment in prison. I was a hard-headed kid, you know. But after I got out of prison the second time, I got sober and it stuck. You know, when I said if you love someone, you won't hurt them. And if you love yourself, you won't hurt yourself, and you'll serve people. And that's what I feel like I'm doing now, is I'm expressing my love to you. I am serving you. And what you get out of it is up to you. You've heard it. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. I think it was Buddha who said it. I'm in charge of what I say. You're in charge of what you hear. I can't impact what you're hearing. That's not my business. I'm just trying to be the best person I can be and leave the outcome up to God. I don't even know what I'm saying for half of the speech. I don't know. I'm just going. I hope I said something okay. You know. And when I said impossible is God's favorite word, you know, and we get out of the way, and good stuff happens. A little girl traveling to Europe, and while she was there, she was admiring the architecture of the great cathedrals, and she was on a tour in one of the cathedrals, and she looked up in the stained glass windows and saw the light coming through them, and asked the tour guide, well, who are these people up in these stained glass windows? And he said, well, those are the saints. She said, oh. So she came back to the States, and some of her friends said, well, what did you see in Europe? And she says, well, I've seen the saints. And they said, well, what do you mean, the saints? Who are the saints? She says, well, the saints, they're the ones that let the light in. And that's what you are, and that's what I am. I am not the light. I'm the stained glass window that the light comes through. And Mary Jo taught me something deep and precious and eternal about forgiveness. Because the person who sexually abused me, when he stepped forward and said that he wanted to make amends, he told a family member, my brother called me and says, guess what? He wants to say sorry. And I had been in AA for I don't know how many years at that point, and I got to admit, I was not in a good place about him. Anytime I'd think of him, I'd think about hitting him with a baseball bat or putting up signs in the neighborhood saying child molester lives here with an arrow all leading to his house, you know, like garage sale signs except for, you know, predator. And but I knew I had to forgive, you know, because that's what they teach in this program. We don't forgive because someone deserves it or not. That's not for us to make that judgment. We forgive not because they deserve it, but because we deserve peace. You know, we do it for us. If we're in a good place within ourselves, then anything that's happening out here, we can deal with it. It might not be easy. I mean, I yelled at our cat last night. Like, yeah, I'm getting ready to give this speech on forgiveness. And the cat goes, meow, meow, meow. I said, shut up. Something like that, yeah. Yeah, and I'm a grown-up. You know. So when the time came to face this guy, I wasn't prepared. I mean, I went to my home group, which was Maplewood Friday night, 6 o'clock, and I told them, because in our home groups we tell people they know all of our warts and blemishes, and they know what's wrong with us. And I said, here's what's going on. I'm scared to death. I don't know if I can meet with this guy. You know, it's difficult. Would you please pray for me? I emailed everyone I knew, asked for prayers, called people. I talked to my sponsor just endlessly. Mary Jo was my sponsor at that time. And but when I first called her, I called her for sympathy. You know, I called her and says, yeah, he asked me to do this, and I don't think I can do it because I just want to kick his, you know what, you know. And I told her, and she says, stop there. You got to do it. I thought, what do you mean I got to do it? And I said, really? She said, yeah. When somebody wants to get well in life, we do not have a right to be an obstacle or a barrier to their getting well. You can't do that. You are in recovery. If he wants to get well, you got to let him, no matter how you feel about it. It's not all about you. Oh, there we go again. And I just told her the same thing that I did about Matt. I don't know if I can do it. And she said, well, you know, I'll go with you if you want me to. And I said, that'd be great. You know, she was a Christian counselor for about 30 years at that point, I think. And she could do some mediations. I did my fifth step with her. She knew everything I'd ever pulled, all of it. Didn't tell her, didn't leave anything out. When I did my fifth step with her, I didn't want to tell her the worst thing. I started with the worst thing. And she was sitting in her chair, and she had her leg crossed, you know, and looking very counselorly, you know, leaning forward just the right amount, like counselors are trained to do, and looking at you with non-judgmental eyes, and warmth in their hearts coming out, you know, and all these right things. And I'm thinking, I got to do this. If I start with the small stuff, by the time I get to the big stuff, I'm not going to want to tell her. So I just threw out the worst thing I ever did, and she went. And then I just stared at her waiting. After about 30 seconds, she says, well, go on. You know. And then I went to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And I got to the end about an hour and a half later, maybe, I don't know how long. And then I was just waiting for the shoe to drop, the punishment to begin. Because every time I had been honest with someone, I got judged. And I got hurt. But she said, I'm going to tell you something. I'm an old lady, she said. I'm going to tell you something that I've told maybe three people in my entire life. And she told me something that she had done. And when she told me, guess what I did? I went, I said, you? I thought only men did stuff like that, you know. Not only men had sexual issues, you know. She said, welcome to the human race. You know, and those sex issues, we got to get them addressed and honestly and compassionately addressed. Do a fifth step. It's a life-changing thing if you do. Just absolutely do it. You know, if you want to stay sober, do it. If you don't care to protect your sobriety, then don't. But if you can do a fifth step and a ninth step, when the hardest time, the biggest trial comes up in your life, because you did those things, you'll be able to weather that storm. It may not be easy. You could lose a loved one, but instead of getting on a plane and drinking over it, you're going to get through it, and you're going to stay sober, and you're going to keep loving the person, whether they're alive or dead, whether they hurt you or they loved you, doesn't matter. Grief is actually love. Grief is a form of praise. It proves that you love someone. We grieve our disease sometimes. When we sober up, we grieve. Injured people injure people. Healed people heal people. And the irony there is that to heal someone, you probably had to be injured before you get to the point of being healed to heal someone. Not always. But those are the people that seem to have our credibility because we know they've been down that road. There's so many counselors that are in Hazelden that have addictions. They may not tell you about it, but they've recovered. A lot of people at Gopher State, they're behind the scenes that are Hazelden employees. And I didn't even know they were Hazelden employees for a while until I started working for Hazelden. I was going, hey, I know you. Hey, I know you. And they're really doing the deal. It's like, wow, right on, you know? when I worked at Fellowship Club, I was so happy because they hired me in a place where I could help people who had what I had. I was there for 2 weeks, and then the state of Minnesota said, he can't work there. He has a crimes that will not allow him to work there. The background study came back, but Hazelden had already hired him. So they put me on call and said, file for a set-aside. I filed for the state of Minnesota. I got references from people in MAD, from police officers that had heard me speak, MAD members, past employers, friends in AA. The state of Minnesota changed their mind and said, okay, yeah, he's good to go. The very difficult thing of losing the full-time position that I had and then going through the process of reclaiming who I really was and being functional about it was very powerful for me. Driving under the influence and killing Timmy, horrible, but look what it's done in my life as far as forgiveness and the messages of love that come out of it. Timmy did not die in vain. Timmy is still alive in the spirit. This picture is a picture of love. This isn't a picture of a tragedy. Why? Because I said so. That's not being manipulative. I was at Gopher State, and there was a woman who was in Al-Anon 30-some years, and I went to tell her about how Sherry and Timmy was my victim and how I was struggling with the pain and the feelings. And she said, stop right there. Timmy is your victim. Sherry is not. She can be well regardless of the alcoholic is drinking or not, or whatever the alcoholic has done in her life, she can be happy no matter what. That's her choice. You don't have that power. It's not your place. And I thought, holy moly, I never thought of her as not being my victim. I wanted to take responsibility for that because I'm an Al-Anon, you know? Isn't that ironic? You know? It's still all about me. So I had to let that go. But the cool thing with Sherry is that for her own reason, she decided to forgive me. But what brought her attention to the fact that she really needed to do something about it and let me know is that her daughter, 19 years old, was driving under the influence in the same town that I drove under the influence and killed Timmy. And she had a crash and injured somebody. And she got charged with DWI, whatever you call it, Missouri, with injury to somebody. She could have killed that person. And she said, oh God, my own daughter could have killed somebody's kid. And I am not giving this guy forgiveness. And I forgive my daughter. Maybe she had to reevaluate the way she viewed life. And she had that shift because of her connection to her daughter. But you know, you talk about synchronicities. We take the worst things that have happened in our life and we provide them as service to other people so they can heal. We don't let it just sit as some funky thing that has happened in our lives and how we've harmed people. It's not what it's about. It's about helping people discover love and forgiveness, transmuting tragedy, turning lead into gold. That's what we do in this program. People in AA laugh about the worst things that you can imagine they're laughing about. And, you know, Alan Honor would probably go, oh my God, I'm laughing about that. There ain't nothing funny about this, you know. They say that in a meeting. Yeah, he's back there laughing. I was going through hell all this time. Now he's all happy and stuff, you know. Thing is, though, the alcoholic ain't her problem. And she is not the alcoholic's problem. We got to quit blaming each other. I'm not your problem. If you don't like something I said, that's on you. You know, if a person is bored in a speech, sorry, welcome to reality. Boredom comes from a boring mind. Al-Anon taught me that. Al-Anon taught me that. Bring it home, man. I'm at a place right now, right on, John. I'm in a place right now where I have some really awesome friends. Some came today, and God bless you. I love you so much. I would have never thought that people could ever love me. My first 8 years in MAD, I wanted to kill myself because I'd drive home and think about how horrible a thing I had done. And I'd be alone, and I didn't have my support driving home, and I'd want to crash my car and kill myself to prove how sorry I was. And Mary Jo was the only MAD member I told that to, and she said, you have a problem of low self-esteem. I want you to do some mirror therapy. Look in the mirror every morning when you get up and tell yourself, Timothy, I love you. And I thought, oh, now I got Joel Osteen, you know, for a sponsor, you know. And I thought it was some cockamamie BS, but I respected her, and I thought, all right, I'll try it. You know, it's real. I honestly felt like it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard. So the next morning, I get up, and I look in the mirror, and I go, Timothy, I love you. I spewed expletives for I don't know how long that went on, man. I didn't know how I really felt about myself. And I said the worst things. You wouldn't talk to anyone that way, ever. It's wrong. But I'm looking in the mirror and I'm doing that to myself, and it was a horrible thing. It's like when you accidentally scratch something and you find that it was a scab, and the scab is bleeding and you see the blood coming out. You go, where'd that come from? You know? I didn't know it was there. I didn't know how injured I really was. And I thought, if I was sexually abused, that means it's my fault. What's wrong with me that someone would do that to me? You know? Well, the good news is it's not my fault, and the good news is it's also not his place to make me heal. You know? And when I met with him, with Mary Jo, I had been praying hard, and we were sitting in front of the restaurant where he was going to come, and I'm sitting there rocking like a Jew at the Wailing Wall or something, you know, and I'm freaking out and going, oh my God, how am I going to do this? I don't know if I'm going to hurt him, if I'm going to kill him, you know. And Mary Jo kept saying, is that him? Is that him? Is that him? Is that him? I go, oh. And, you know, I was like, shut up. And finally, she said, is that him? And then there was some spiritual magic that was in the air. And I felt it. I felt that it was palpable. And I started to look up slowly, and as I started to look up toward the person coming into the facility, I saw these colors, every color imaginable coming down out of the sky. It was like all the colors of the rainbow, but they were like water fire. And they just came down, and right when I looked at them, all that energy, all that power came down from up there somewhere, and it went straight into my chest, and as soon as I made eye contact with them, I had nothing but pure, unadulterated love for him. Love was placed in my chest by my higher power, God. And God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I couldn't forgive him. I couldn't do it. Corrie Ten Boom said that we forgive regardless of the temperature of our hearts. It doesn't necessarily happen overnight. It took some serious prayer, and it was a miracle that that happened. And when I sat down and he said what he said, and he said he was sorry, he said, what, do you hate me now? And I said, no, I love you. And he just about choked, literally choked on that, hearing that he was loved rather than hated. Just like the young man who heard he was loved and forgiven in the courtroom. It's what we do for each other in these programs. We just love each other. We don't judge. We don't gossip. We just love each other. As we are. God meets us where we're at. We meet people where they're at. We don't get ready to meet God. We meet God to get ready. You know, that's how I view it anyway. And I got everything I've gotten from that I've said today, I've gotten from other people. Ripped it all off. Unapologetically. I'm just like a parrot that sat in a meeting for 25 years, you know, and I'm just up here repeating stuff I heard people say, you know. You know? I rarely have an original thought, and if I have an original thought, I like, you know, I put it in the suspect box, you know. Because I doubt that it's a good idea, you know. My girlfriend knows. I have an original thought, you know. Mm-hmm. It's my medallion. Got out on August 17th, drank on the 18th, sobered up on the 19th. There is when I was working at, I think that was Fellowship Club. It could have been Hazelden Center for Youth and Family. I'm not really sure. So when I first got locked up, that's what I looked like in Missouri. Could barely grow. It took me about a month to grow that that little thing under my chin. But the day that I got brought to arraignment at the courthouse in Missouri, we drove up to the next morning, the day after the Timmy dying, we drove up to the courthouse, and when I looked up at the courthouse, there was a steeple in the courthouse with a clock that read 11:15. And that's when I knew what that dream meant, and it just stunned me. said, oh my God, I told the cop, I said, I've seen this before. And he looked around all freaked out, you know. He said, what? I said, this. And I told him about the dream. He went into the court and he told the judge I was trying to beat the case on, with an insanity defense. Literally told him that. They sent me to the Biggs building, the hospital for the criminally insane, because it's the only place they could send me to keep me incarcerated while checking me out to see if I was nuts or not. Who knows why we have these dreams, you know? You ever have a dream come true? Yeah, that was one of them for me. So anyway, they printed me up, and these are some pictures of the inside of the Missouri State Penitentiary. That was the death house, upper right. Lower right was A Hall. That was the honor hall. Never made it there. And a couple other halls. There is me when I was 21 years old in the prison chapel. It's one of the few places we could get a photograph on a weekday. On the weekends, we could do it on the yard. There I was at 22 years old. Want to take my gun, come and get it. Nobody comes out the way they come in. They go in, you know. I started a little gang and did some things that I'm not proud of, but, you know, instead of getting weller, I got sicker. There I was out in the yard playing bones with a few of the guys. There they were transferring me to another prison, and they were trying to get a good photograph of me, and I was doing this. They said, quit doing that. I said, they were transferring me to try and kill a lawsuit that I'd filed, and there was two guards that came to my cell one day before I was transferred, and they said, so why are you filing all these lawsuits for all these effing niggers? And I said, the lawsuits are there because of the way you treat people. Treat people better, they won't happen. I was scared for my life. I thought they were going to take me out of that cell and kill me or something, because they were not happy. And they were very ill people. And people have died for filing things seriously. I don't want to go there too much, but I was worried for my own life. But a different guard who liked me told me that they were going to transfer me to another prison and told me why, to make the suit moot so I can join the prisons before I even got there. By the time I got to the new prison, the paperwork came from the court that very same day adding that prison to the lawsuit. Oh my God, they were so mad. Now they got two prisons on the hook. There I was in Stillwater Prison, one of the cells. I was in Oak Park Heights Prison, Category 5 prison, one of the most secure in the country. There was before I got out of Stillwater, shortly before. Loved chess. I think it helped keep me alive. Poetry and chess. There was when I got out of Stillwater. And then 2 days later. And this was up in the AA club. I saw that, and it reminded me of the picture my grandmother had of me up on her TV for all those years. And I just had a sense of being home when I saw that, and being in that sacred space where people actually loved me where I was at. You know, and I talked about wanting to kill myself for a long time. People just loved me exactly where I was at. 8 years later of telling myself daily that I love you in the mirror, one day I meant it. And I probably actually did sound like Joel Osteen that day. I said, Timothy, I love you. And when I looked at myself, I meant it. And I looked for the convict. Where'd the convict go? Where'd the hater go? Where'd this guy who's got all these issues disappear to? And I was so jubilant. I ran down to the Maplewood Club, and they're out smoking cigarettes, waiting for the meeting to start. And I ran up.